I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Pennsylvania Republican U.S. Senator Pat Toomey says with a GOP president headed to the White House and Congress under the party's control, he's looking forward to changing government policies in big ways. Toomey spoke with reporters today, and WHYY's Dave Davies was there.
Toomey says the new president can do a lot quickly by revoking some of President Obama's executive orders on environmental regulation and a host of other issues. Legislation, he says, will take more time, but he's anxious to get started on repealing Obamacare. He says he knows millions of people now get insurance through the Affordable Care Act.
We can't pull the rug out from under people all at once. We can't leave people stranded in some way, so there has to be a transition.
A transition to what? Toomey says it will take some months to work out details, but
what I want is for individuals to be in control of their health care, for insurance companies to have to compete, for there to be robust competition across a wide range of products and services. I'm interested in ways that people can have portability of their health insurance, renewability of their health insurance.
In other words, give consumers real choices, real information, and real competition among providers, and good things will happen. Asked if insurance companies should be permitted to deny coverage based on pre-existing conditions, Toomey says those with high-cost chronic conditions have to be able to afford care. One idea is to put them in high-risk pools with special insurance coverage that, he acknowledges, might need a government subsidy.
Government massively subsidizes health care today. Medicaid is almost free health care for people who qualify for it. Medicare is heavily subsidized, so there will be subsidies. But we can deal with that without having this draconian government takeover of the entire sector.
Toomey never publicly endorsed Trump and says he still has concerns about the president-elect's ideas and his temperament, but thinks they'll have a productive working relationship. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
When a large energy company got a tax break in 2014 to move to Camden, local officials were thrilled at the prospect of hundreds of new jobs, though there was little discussion about the product Holtec International intended to build inside its new factory on the Delaware River. It's a new, small type of nuclear reactor that's never been built before and which has no definite customers. Now critics are questioning whether Holtec will be the latest to fail to deliver on promises of new jobs for Camden. WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports.
First of all, let's define one thing. A small modular reactor is a new type of nuclear reactor, and it's what Holtec intends to design and build in Camden. It's smaller than traditional reactors. It can be assembled almost entirely in a factory, and manufacturers say it's safer. But not everybody is a fan. M.V. Romana studies the nuclear industry at Princeton University.
I don't think that there is a market out there which is anywhere guaranteed. I don't think that these large number of jobs that they promise are going to really materialize.
Because for all the benefits of small nuclear reactors, critics like Romana say there are problems too, and that those problems might scare away customers. First, critics say energy companies overstate how cheap and safe small modular reactors will actually be. The technology is so new that none of the U.S. companies trying to build small reactors, including Holtec, have actually made one yet. And second, renewable energies like wind and solar are becoming cheaper than ever to produce. That undercuts interest in nuclear. Mark Cooper, a senior economic fellow at the Vermont Law School, puts it another way.
There is no genuine prospect for economically competitive small modular reactors.
And this matters right now because Holtec is promising 250 new jobs in Camden building these small reactors. In fact, company officials have suggested there could be 10,000 jobs there by 2030. And while the picture painted by critics may worry some of the people who are holding out hope for those jobs, Holtec is not worried. The company got a $250 million tax break to build its new factory in Camden. And in its application, Holtec painted a much rosier picture of the demand for small reactors. It predicted a, quote, $1 trillion market over the next 25 years and claimed that, quote, Holtec is at the forefront in this high-stakes global race.
Not only is there a massive market for energy, but we faithfully believe that there's a differentiating benefit out there for people who can deliver reliable energy safe energy in ways that are different than are available in the market today.
Holtec Vice President Tom Marcil runs the small nuclear reactor division. He says prospective customers have already given a, quote, soft yes to buying Holtec's new reactor, which is still under development.
I would say there's a half a dozen solid clients today for the SMR-160, and we're actively engaged in discussions and work efforts with all of them.
More than that, he says it makes sense for Holtec to set up shop in Camden before it's finished its design or secured firm commitments from customers. If the factory is up and running by the time the company finishes its reactor, it'll be able to build the parts right away and get a jump on the competition.
One of the things that you have to recognize from, I guess, the history of industrialized America is those people and those industrial founders who've had a vision and a belief in something have made commitments at an earlier and faster pace than others around them.
Holtec is also confident it won't have to fire anybody if the small reactor gambit doesn't work out. Those workers will simply manufacture one of the many other products the company already makes. Here's what Holtec President Chris Singh had to say at a recent event in Camden.
Holtec has never had a layoff. We have never had a layoff for lack of work.
But even if Holtec bets big on the small nuclear reactor, and that bet does pay off, are these the types of jobs Camden really needs?
Well, we need factory jobs. We need entry-level jobs. Like I, that got me my start in chemical soup. That's how I got started. That's how I was able to pay for my college education.
Kelly Francis is president of the Camden chapter of the NAACP. Francis is happy the company is offering jobs to Camden residents. He says the city is all too familiar with corporate promises that never pan out. There have been decades of plans to revitalize Camden that often benefit those outside the city. But he's worried that the high-tech jobs Holtec is promising are too advanced for low-skill workers who call Camden home. And a recent survey by the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia agrees. Economic development organizations surveyed said the tax incentives New Jersey is giving to companies moving to Camden will leave little space for businesses hiring entry-level workers. Holtec is addressing that problem by offering free training programs for local residents. But Francis says he's heard these promises before from companies that have set up shop in Camden, like the Adventure Aquarium and the music venue that's now called the BB&T Pavilion.
Oh, there's going to be jobs for Camden residents. The only people I see working there are suburbanites. But these are the promises they make in order to get a foothold.
Holtec insists this time will be different. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
President-elect Donald Trump made immigration reform a huge part of his campaign and the agenda for his first 100 days in office. Trump has promised to end funding to so-called sanctuary cities like Philadelphia and deport millions of unauthorized residents. WHYY's Laura Benchoff spoke to Latino immigrants.
In northeast Philadelphia, Estella Hernandez is sitting in her brightly painted living room near a gurgling fish tank. She says the hardest thing about Donald Trump winning the presidency was seeing her three children react.
The first day when we woke up and saw he won, my kids' reaction was despair.
Hernandez is from Mexico and owns a house cleaning business. She's also undocumented, one of at least 11 million people Trump promised to deport during his campaign. 5 miles south of Hernandez's house, Mexican immigrant and permanent U.S. resident Gerardo Flores dishes out tacos from a small food truck. His biggest worry over a Trump administration is that people without papers who live in dangerous neighborhoods won't feel comfortable talking to police.
We live in communities where there's lots of crime. It would be even harder for people to feel safe if they feel like they can't speak up if that's happening.
That could be the case if Trump makes good on a promise to cut off federal funding to sanctuary cities that limit coordination between police and immigration officials. So far, Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney's staff says he is standing behind the city's sanctuary policy. And while Hernandez and Flores both mention fear, they also say they're prepared to organize to keep their families safe and in this country.
En mi persona,
Me, personally, from the very same fear that Donald Trump's election causes in me, I also get a lot of courage.
After all, Hernandez says she's lived with the fear of being deported for a long time. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benshaw.
Even casual students of colonial American history are familiar with the Boston Tea Party. What may be overlooked is the extent to which Pennsylvania is front and center when considering the clashes that helped define America's founding era. That's the case laid out by Patrick Spiro, librarian at the American Philosophical Society, in his new book entitled Frontier Country, The Politics of War in Early Pennsylvania. Dr. Spiro, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So long before the Boston Tea Party and the Stamp Act protests was the Paxton Boys Rebellion in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Correct. 1763, a group of frontiersmen raided a Native American community called the Conestogas and exterminated the entire tribe, left no Conestoga remaining. And then they marched, over 200 people marched the 90 miles to Philadelphia from Lancaster to protest the government's policies towards their frontier regions, towards Native Americans. They had serious issues with the Quakers and their views on Indian relations. And so there's an incredible conflict between what is the role of government and what is the government's proper position towards Native American groups. The Quakers, of course, and many in Pennsylvania more generally, saw the Indians as potential friends and allies and those they wanted to incorporate into their community, while many on the frontier saw them as people that should be excluded and, in fact, deserve no rights.
And it is the role of the imperial government, the monarchy, which these Paxton Rebellion advocates felt was letting them down.
Yeah, well, it's an imperial crisis. It's a crisis of governing where the British Empire wanted to integrate Native American groups into their empire. They saw them as trading partners, as potential allies. The British Empire did not want to fight any more wars. The French and Indian War, the Seven Years' War, there was a rebellion called Pontiac's Rebellion in 1763. All of these things had cost the British Empire an enormous amount of money. And they were weighted, they had this incredible debt that was weighing them down. And so they said, we need to reconsider Native Americans and their place within our empire. We need them to be trading partners. We need to have peace on the frontier. And what you saw is colonists had come to a very different view of Native Americans. They saw them through a racial lens. They saw all Indians as enemies who should be excluded from the polity. And what I argue is that that is the crux of the imperial crisis on the American frontier in the 1760s and 1770s. It's a very different story from what was happening in the seaports.
You know, the Stamp Act and the Boston Tea Party are defining moments. Was this Paxton Boys Rebellion a similar defining moment in Pennsylvania or part of a growing sense of the tension and clashes?
I think the Paxton Boys were a turning point. This is a moment where colonists rebelled against their government. They challenged the very authority of the government. The Conestogas were a peaceful group who were allied with the colony. The Paxton Boys killed them. And there was no prosecution of the Paxton Boys. Basically, what you had was a complete vacuum of governing authority on the Pennsylvania frontier in the 1760s and 1770s, which is why Virginia is able to come in and say Pittsburgh's ours and to win and to establish their authority. So basically, the Paxton Boys is the start of what I would argue is the movement towards independence on the Pennsylvania frontier.
Let's note that on Monday, attendees at a moderated event across the street from our studios at the National Constitution Center will hear you and Michael Klarman, Harvard Law professor, discuss the topic, Rethinking America's Founding. Have our schools and history courses been lacking in telling America's story by focusing on certain events at the exclusion of others?
No, I think what is happening right now is a reevaluation of the American Revolution. To see it beyond just, as you were saying, the Stamp Act or the Tea Party or the Boston Massacre, to uncover all the other stories that happened in the midst of the American Revolution, to reimagine Philadelphia not only as the site where the Declaration of Independence was written, but also as an occupied city. The British occupied Philadelphia during the Valley Forge winter. What was it like to be an occupied city? What was Newport like to be an occupied city? What was happening in the countryside during this occupation. And so these are the questions that I think scholars are now asking. How can we break outside of this narrative that we know so well and discover new unknown stories?
Patrick Spiro, librarian at the American Philosophical Society. His new book is entitled Frontier Country, The Politics of War in Early Pennsylvania, and he'll be appearing at a moderated event at the National Constitution Center Monday entitled Rethinking America's Founding. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. When Prairie Home Companion comes to the Academy of Music in Philadelphia this Saturday, attendees will savor powder milk biscuits and the sounds of musicians Jason Isbell, Anjali Kidjo, and newly named host Chris Thiele. Chris, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you are newly named in this capacity, although apparently you made several guest appearances as host.
This last one was my seventh total, but only third as a non-guest host, as just a straight-up host.
And so now that you are in that capacity, do you have a big hand in deciding who's going to be coming aboard with you?
I do. I get to sit in my room and think about all the people I'd love to work with and what sort of stuff would be fun for us to do, tell a story or a joke.
Or recite a poem.
Exactly. Oh, gosh. Billy Collins at the Philly show, I think the world of his poetry. Actually, I met him on the first show that I ever guest hosted. I was unaware of his work and have actually, since that show, kept a book of his poetry in my backpack at all times.
Now, your current iteration for the show, I believe, is called The First Call Radio Players.
That's the house band, yes.
And there are a couple of members of Punch Brothers in that band.
That's Paul Cowart, our bass player, and our guitarist, Chris Eldridge, although I think you will be seeing in Philly an alternate house band, but there'll be some wonderful players, including Stuart Duncan, who's one of the most righteous fiddlers of all time, Greg Garrison, an ex-Punch Brother, Greg Garrison. My duet partner will be Lydia Rogers from the Secret Sisters. It's going to be a fun show.
Now, I don't know how far back some listeners go, but either Punch Brothers or Nickel Creek, of course, prior to that. Where do you find the time? You've taken on this task of hosting Prairie Home Companion, but I took a look at your tour dates and you haven't slowed down a bit.
The show is a pretty absorbing enterprise. The last 3 weeks, doing three shows back to back, exhilarating to say the least. You start kind of working on it the Sunday after the last one. And I write a new song for each episode that usually revolves around what time it is during the year or where we happen to be. I've been thinking about some cherished Philadelphia memories. I love roaming around downtown in Philly, particularly there around Rittenhouse Square and where the Curtis Institute is. There's so much personality there. There's so much humanity to observe. I think I might dive into that for the song for that show.
You have signed on, as it were, for, I believe, around a dozen episodes of Prairie Home Companion.
Yeah, there are 13 this year. At some point, they'll tell us whether people are enjoying it enough for it to continue or not.
Would it be at your pleasure?
Oh, absolutely. This is just a thrill beyond description.
I listened to your description describing it as getting a winning Monopoly card.
Yeah, exactly. It feels like that community chess card, bank error in your favor. It's like collect a phone call from Garrison Keillor offering you the post that was, a dream of yours as a child. Like, I used to pretend to be Garrison Keillor, along with being a Jedi Knight or starting pitcher for the Cubs.
I don't want to draw the straight line, but what's the difference between Woe Be Gone Days and Make America Great Again in terms of making this show relevant in 2016 and beyond? Is it paying homage to a notion of what once was?
Variety shows, in a way, are nostalgic. They were all the rage however many years ago, 50, 60 years ago. But I actually feel that they are as satisfying a way to present the beautiful things that human beings make for each other as there possibly could be. And I think this format that Garrison created, the swirling mass of music and spoken word, be it comedy or storytelling or the scripts or fake commercials, whatever it is, those things make you want each other and they propel the show forward to the extent that 2 hours goes by in a flash.
That's where that sense of community or magic takes place. From my end, as a fan and an attendee, describe what it's like, though, from the other end to be on stage and look out. What do you get back from either the Prairie Home Companion audience or when you're performing with the Punch Brothers.
That is a joy, because that's the process completed. You know, there's nothing that brings me more pleasure than experiencing something good with people. And for me, music is the thing probably that's given me the most of that kind of pleasure. For instance, I had this, it's a Philly story. The latest Radiohead record came out on a day off that I had in Philadelphia earlier this year. And I downloaded it on iTunes the day it came out and sat there in this lovely coffee shop and listened to the whole thing and then listened to it again on the walk back to the hotel and then listened to it once more before dinner. And I came to the point of tears listening to the last song on that record, True Love Waits. I'll drown my beliefs. To have your babies. I'll dress like your niece. And wash your swollen feet. And I think that the reason I bring it up is that my experience performing on stage is actually very similar, I think, to your experience from your end of that, watching me perform on stage. That ultimately we are sharing something and you are participating in the meaning of that experience just as much as I am.
Chris Thiele, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having me.
And you can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight. Thank you.